I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. The journalist Arno Kopeski joins me now. This past fall, he released his latest book, The Oil Man and the Sea. It's an engaging book that's part travelogue and part memoir of the few months he sailed British Columbia's west coast, chiefly, to the Great Bear Rainforest, which is at the heart of the debate over Enbridge's Northern Gateway Pipeline. If the project goes through and bitumen is piped to the coast, it's through the waters Mr. Kopeski navigated that tankers will pass. What he's done in this book is show the reader what's there now, what sort of wildlife is found there, and how the communities up and down the coast feel, and how they'd be affected by all of this. There are dire warnings about the seaways and the navigational challenges that most say it's not a question of if a spill will occur, but when. I'll ask Mr. Kopeski about worst-case scenarios and what he thinks might happen. On Wednesday, the 29th of January, he'll be headlining Insight with Charles Montgomery, author of The Happy City. That's at the Central Branch of the Vancouver Public Library at 7:30, put on by our friends at the Vancouver Writers Festival. The website for more is at arnokopeski.com. His first book was The Devil's Curve, and he appears in sundry publications, including The Walrus, Globe and Mail, Reader's Digest, and Foreign Policy. This book is published by Douglas and McIntyre. Please welcome to the Plant Online program, Arno Kopeski. Mr. Kopeski, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Pretty good. Yourself?
I'm great, thanks.
I understand you're in Sook today.
I am, yeah. Over to the island, actually staring out at the ocean I love as we speak.
Yeah. So did you spend much time on the coast, say, traveling up and down the coast, as you have in this book?
You mean prior to...
Prior to
the travels that informed the book. Yeah, I went to. I grew up in Edmonton, Alberta, so quite a ways from the ocean, much closer to the oil sands actually, and went to University of Victoria in the late '90s into 2001. So that was sort of my exposure, sort of slow 6-year education, both at school and a little bit on the water, getting to know the ocean back in those days.
So you spent how many months on the Foxy going?
Just over 3 months for the voyage that informed us, the Oil Man and the Sea. We left on June 30th. We set sail out of Sydney's harbor just outside of Victoria at the bottom of Vancouver Island, and then we sailed forth on June 30th of 2012, and that voyage lasted until mid-October, basically.
And so whose idea was it? You had someone else with you, Ilya Herb. He's a photographer,
right? Yeah, it was sort of a mutually, I think probably both of us at various times tried to take credit for having the idea or disavowing that we had anything to do with the early idea. But Ilya bought a boat just to fulfill a lifelong dream, basically. He bought the sailboat Foxy, 41-foot cutter. He bought that in, I think it was January of 2012 or December of 2011, right around there. And as soon as he got that, you know, Northern Gateway had already been dominating the headlines. And Ilya's been a friend of mine for many years, and we've gone on a few assignments around the world together to cover these similar stories. We'd gone to Iceland together in 2005 to look at that country's attempt to become the first oil-free nation on the planet. That was prior to the financial meltdown that I think has distracted them lately. But so we had done those kinds of stories, but never anything in our backyard before, Ilya and I. And then when he had the sailboat, I think we both kind of, it just sort of leapt out at us that we had a chance now to go and see a place that everybody was talking about, but very few people had actually spent any serious time in themselves. And that was the Great Bear Rainforest, which is the heart of the oil tanker route.
And so there's no other route for these tankers. Once the oil is piped from Alberta to this coast, there's no other route for them to go, right?
There's lots of other routes if they put the pipeline somewhere else. But if they put the pipeline to Kitimat, as Northern Gateway calls for, then no, there's no other route. I mean, one way or another, you have to get through the heart of this Great Bear Rainforest. And it's a labyrinth in there, so there's, you know, you can zig instead of zag around this island versus that island, that kind of thing, but you're still going through the heart of, you know, some of the most pristine marine environment and most abundant and fertile marine environment on the planet.
So that animation that Enbridge put out, where it seems to be clear sailing for the tankers. That's not true, right?
No, that's right. You're referring to sort of an infamous animation that Enbridge had posted on their website, and I think they had some commercials going around where it depicted the tanker route as just a wide open, straight blue hallway, basically from Kitimat to the open ocean. And so they had erased several hundred islands from the tanker route, including the very first island on the tanker route is Gill Island, which happens to be the ferry that the Queen of the North, BC ferry, Queen of the North, struck and sank upon in 2006. So yeah, there was a little bit of disingenuity going on with the Enbridge animation. And I met a woman who worked for sort of the Enbridge as a little field office in Kitimat. And we were there. We had sort of had, it was the apex of our sailing trip that we were anchored off of Kitimat. And so I went and visited the office, and it happened to be just around the time that this animation had come out. And I said, you know, don't you think that it's a little bit dishonest to portray the route this way? And you know, she had nothing to do with this thing, and she was getting 100 phone calls telling her exactly that. But she looked like she really honestly believed, you know. She just said, no, I think, you know, they just want to sort of get the message across that it's a very, you know, I actually think that she was being honest and genuine, that she didn't think that there was any willful dishonesty somehow. But as far as I could tell, they had erased several hundred islands from the map. Yeah.
So how was the navigation process sailing up and down the coast with you and Mr. Herb? How did you find that? I mean, you're obviously, the boat's not as big as a ferry, but it was still a challenge to navigate, right?
Yeah, I mean, both of us were rookies. We'd never sailed before really at all. So this is partly a misadventure story and, you know, the story of us sort of learning how to sail on the fly. A friend of ours who is an experienced sailor joined us for the first 2 weeks, and he showed us the ropes, so to speak, and then we were on our own. So it was stressful navigating a 41-foot boat for the first time in these waters, of course, especially when the whole point of our journey was to highlight how volatile and dangerous these waters are for bigger vessels than our own. But we had 3 months of fabulous weather, so we really lucked out that way. And in the summertime, it's a whole different beast. I mean, if the weather was always like what it was between, you know, July and September, if that kind of weather was 12 months a year, then this would be a different conversation that we're having. But it's not. In eight or nine months of the year, it's a completely different environment than what we surveyed.
And so in the wintertime, it's a lot more treacherous, et cetera. When you were sailing through this, there obviously wasn't a lot of traffic, right? And I'm assuming if and when this pipeline goes through, traffic will increase.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I learned a lot on this trip about BC's north and central coast. In particular, you know, industry has really declined there in the last 20 years. So through most of the 20th century, there would have been a lot more marine traffic than what we saw, mostly tugboats and barges, wood barges, and you know, some freighters as well, but sort of serving the logging industry primarily and the fishing industry. A lot of fishing fleets were out there. And then with the decline of the softwood lumber industry in Canada and in BC, as well as a serious decline in fisheries, fish stocks from herring and salmon to halibut, you name it. So the last 20 years have really seen sort of a clawback in industry. And because of that, actually, the very things that I just was talking about, forests and fish, have had a chance to grow back. So we're in this sort of magical in-between time where the industry hasn't yet returned. There's very little traffic on those waters, and the wildlife is becoming abundant again, and the forests are growing back, and the clear cuts are starting to become invisible. So it's this magical time, but it's sort of standing on the precipice, because not only is Northern Gateway about to descend upon the region, if all goes according to the Joint Review Panel's decision, but also there's a whole lot of natural gas tankers that are going to be coming down, because Kitimat is about to become a major energy exporting hub. So whatever happens with Northern Gateway, there's definitely going to be a lot more tanker traffic in the waters that we were sailing through, and that's going to have a pretty profound impact. I guess the question is just how much will it have? And will they ship oil instead of gas? Because those are two different things when they spill. And oil is, I think, you know, indisputably far, far, far more harmful to an ocean environment than natural gas, which has its own problems at the source, but would mostly evaporate if there was a tanker accident with natural gas.
So the worst case scenario then, I guess, is an oil spill, and that's what everyone's afraid of.
Yeah.
So it would dramatically change the landscape, kill a bunch of wildlife, etc., right?
Yeah, and there's a lot of different ways. You know, it depends when it spills, how much it spills, where it is when it spills. You know, is it in a place that, and, you know, does it spill at Heckett Strait when the tide is coming in, and then, and the currents are extremely strong, so that that load gets distributed over several hundred kilometers of coastline, or does it spill in sort of an isolated little cove? So the worst case scenario is, of course, that it spills somewhere in the open where the currents distribute it several hundred kilometers, and it's either, you know, right in the spring when the herring are starting to spawn, or let's say right in the fall when salmon are choking the rivers, and that's exactly, you know, there's certain particular times when the ocean is particularly vulnerable because these, you know, salmon, let's say, have filled the rivers with their eggs, and then an entire generation of happens to be right on the coastline, right when this oil slick comes in and covers them, and then you have an entire generation of salmon wiped out in one fell swoop. And so that's exactly what happened in Prince William Sound in Alaska with the Exxon Valdez spill, and that's why everybody, you know, that's of course the iconic image that we're left with, where, you know, 25 years later you can still scoop oil off from the beaches with your bare hands about 700 kilometers from where the actual spill occurred. And it happened during the herring run, not the salmon run there, so it was spring. And that herring run has yet to recover, and several salmon stocks in that region are really seriously depleted as well.
So when Enbridge says that they have, you know, navigational technology that'll help all of, or prevent all of these things from happening, so say they have tugs that'll take the tankers through. At the same time, the government says that they'll be able to handle a spill. These things don't matter to you? They don't make sense to you, perhaps?
Well, I feel like they're couching their terms in very vague promises, basically. They're saying, you hear the words world-class technology a lot. You hear, you know, anytime I hear that latest technology, world-class technology, I think of the Titanic. And in this case, actually, there is a lot of empty promises. I mean, BC's Auditor General and Canada's Environmental Auditor General have both found in recent years that British Columbia actually has no capacity for oil spill response. We don't have any. We have tugboats that can push and pull tankers around, but we don't have any barges that can actually withstand the kind of weather that is likely to be happening on our coast. And, you know, if you look at the most recent big oil spill to hit headlines was in the Gulf of Mexico. That was BP's spill. And that was in a glassy, calm, sunny, warm conditions on the Gulf Coast. And they recovered about 10% of the oil. And that was oil that floats. It was light oil. It's not bitumen, which is, recent studies are indicating actually will sink, or at least will be partially submerged. So there's no, it's basically an outright lie to say that we are, have or have plans in place to have, you know, world-class technology to recover an oil spill. You can talk about double-hulled tankers, you hear a lot, and those have been international law since 1991. So it's not exactly the latest standards. It's good that we have them. It's good that we're not applying Somalian standards of seaworthiness to our coast, or, you know, changing laws to make it worse. But don't represent it as something new or triumphant. It's been the U.S. Coast Guard estimated that if Exxon Valdez had had a double hull, because it didn't, it had a single hull. Mm-hmm. But if it had had a double hull, they still estimate that it would have lost about 50% of its load, which is still 150,000 barrels of oil or so. And I guess the last thing that I would say to all that is, you know, Enbridge is not a shipping company. They have never built a ship or operated any kind of an oil tanker scheme in their existence. They're a pipeline company. They make pipelines and they pipe oil. So a lot of this talk is really public relations. And, you know, they're hiring teams of people who do know what they're doing. But Enbridge itself is not in the business of tanking oil around the world. And it's a little bit crazy to give them the responsibilities for that and to just blindly trust them when they say, well, we have the latest technology. Because I think if you take a serious look at what they mean by the latest technology, it's and measure up. And I go into that in the book in a lot more detail, but it gets somewhat laborious to talk about some of those technical details just on the air.
Yeah. Traveling this route as you have, what I found interesting in the book is the conversations that you had with natives, because their communities will be affected a great deal, whether or not the worst case scenario happens. What did you glean about their relationship with the government from talking to natives, as you have through your travels in this book?
Well, I took a lot of hope from it, because I feel like if you look at the relationship at the governmental level of sort of band council chiefs with Canada's provincial and federal leaders, you just see a lot of acrimony and strife and disagreement, and it kind of looks hopeless, and it just looks like this huge quagmire where, you know, how is anyone going to agree? There's so much history and there's so much rancor. But to just go into those communities, and, you know, we were in Bella Bella, which is the home of the Heiltsuk Nation. We spent time in Hartley Bay, which is the home of the Gitgat Nation, and Kitimat Village itself is where the Haisla live. We spent time in each of those communities, and it was, you know, we were a little bit nervous going in. We didn't know how we'd be received. We haven't, for me personally, I hadn't spent a lot of time in First Nations reserves up until this trip. And so that was part of the joy of and the excitement of this journey, was to be able to do that, but also, you know, a little bit trepidatious about it. But it was so gratifying to do that and to make as many, I feel it's hard to say some of the stuff without sounding trite about it, but it's true that it was so easy to make friends, and there was so much that we had in common, that it really gave the lie to what we see at the political level, or at least it made me hope that, you know, these are the same, we can build friendships and have these human relationships based on mutual respect and trust and appreciation, without having to assimilate one another. And if we can do that at the social level, then surely we can replicate some of that goodwill at a higher political level. And that gives me hope for these bigger conversations that transcend any pipeline project or any one industry, but are about so much more.
So this book's been out since the fall, is that right?
Pardon me?
This book, The Oil Man and the Sea, it's been out since the fall?
Yeah, that's right. Came out in October of 2013.
And so the reaction to it has been pretty good, hasn't it?
Yeah, I've been really happy with the reaction that I've heard. It hasn't been thunderous, but it's been positive. You know, nobody has registered any major complaints, at least not publicly that I'm aware of. That day may yet come. It's early days, but so far I've been really pleased with how this is received. And I think it was such a group effort. We raised a lot of money publicly through, we held public fundraisers, and our community and strangers all pitched in to help sort of fund this expedition, because, you know, a boat trip like that costs a little bit of money. And so it was really sort of a crowdsourced mission in it. And it's certainly not me. I see this whole thing as very reaffirming of community and again, building these connections that I think are go beyond any one book or project, or, you know, this is sort of the social implications of where we're at in a world that's at the sixth great extinction, you know, in our oceans and our atmosphere. And there's so much going on that's somewhat frightening to contemplate. But if you can do little things like this and build little communities, then that gives a person hope as a weapon.
Now, even in Alberta, when you took this book to, say, Edmonton and Calgary, it was received well?
It was, yeah. I mean, I had sort of book launch parties in each of those cities. I grew up in Edmonton, so I have a lot of community there, and I have quite a few friends in Calgary as well. So both of those events were well attended, and much cheer was felt. And, I was really gratified. It was interesting being, I think in some of the media interviews, I was also always warmly received, but you could tell that the way the questions are couched and framed in Alberta, you can assume less about your audience, about your audience's beliefs there than you can here, I think. Or for me, at least, that there's going to be you're couched in the assumption that, well, hydrocarbons are the thing that let us do what we do as a society. And that, of course, is true. I think people are more aware of that in Alberta than they are out here in BC.
So I looked you up on YouTube the other day, And I watched one of these interviews that you gave, one of these talk shows. I think it was in Edmonton.
Oh, dear.
And there was a comment on the bottom of the video, at the bottom of the video. And this is obviously not a fan of you or your message.
The comment trolls. I haven't read this. Let's hear it.
Yeah, so the person said that that you weren't to be believed, or that whatever you had to say ought to be discounted because you're part of some concerted effort with an agenda that doesn't like, say, Canadian oil to be put on the market because it'll keep the prices of oil higher.
Right.
I'm sure you've heard this. I mean, I talked to Kai Nagata this week. This is something that he's also heard. When you hear things like that, and then you can respond to that if you wish, but when you hear arguments like that against you or against other people, against certain organizations, do you find that more of a diversionary tactic in terms of wanting to choke debate and sort of not even talk about the message or the argument that you're trying to make, but really just to sort of discount you because they think you're being paid off by somebody?
Yeah, I mean, my first response is to ignore it unless enough people are clamoring that that's the case and that it forces me to deal with it. I mean, that's how I feel for both sides, because I feel as many people as launched those kinds of attacks that green groups or, you know, environmentally minded people like Kai Nagata and myself, our side also does that to the other. And conspiracy theories, everywhere you look, somebody's got a conspiracy theory. And I have little patience for any of them, including the ones that are directed towards me, because I think they're just so obviously not rooted in fact. You know, and I guess I feel like it amounts to an ad hominem attack where you're attacking the person instead of his argument. And so, as far as if anyone, the critiques to which I feel obliged to respond are if anyone says I'm wrong in any particular argument. You know, if somebody says, that's not true, Enbridge did include the forecast that 300 other, because in my book I say Enbridge, in their risk assessment model, they didn't even account for the fact that 300 plus gas, liquefied natural gas tankers are going to be plying the same waters. So, you know, and my point was that they're ignoring all of these factors in their risk assessment. And if somebody tries to say, well, that's not true, you're lying, then I'll address that. But if they're just saying, oh, you're part of some big conspiracy that's out to smother the world and it's, you know, oil-free rhetoric, I mean, I've actually never been one to say that we need to shut the tar sands down. I think that's an unrealistic goal, and I think it would be catastrophic and impossible anyway. So my argument is always just let's manage the growth of this beast that we've created. Let's level off growth of this thing. Let's keep production where it's at. And let's talk about slowing down the growth, but not the actual production that we have. And so, if people have a critique of that, and if they think that's unrealistic, then I'm happy to talk about those things. But if they're just going to say that I'm part of, or anybody, you know, when people are like, well, there's four families that own every oil company in the world, and they're running the planet, it's like, it's so obviously bullshit.
Do you find that the media plays into that and gives conspiracy theorists and the sort credence? I mean, I know I have right
really.
Now. I understand, but I mean,
yeah, I guess you know what's happening right now. But I mean, no, generally I don't. I mean, it's a fun topic to I think conspiracy theories and stuff like that. I don't think generally the media. I think the media is somewhat a slave to content, so it needs content, and sometimes its hunger overwhelms its judgment, but hey, we're all victims of that sometimes.
And do you find that British Columbians are generally well informed on the subject of Northern Gateway, on pipelines, the politics surrounding that?
I think so. I think, you know, one of the reactions I've had to my book is a lot of people were surprised about the tanker and some of the stuff about what's going on BC's central coast in terms of, you know, people hadn't been that open an idea about the First Nations who live there. They didn't realize quite how crazy the oil tanker was in its various particulars. So I think there's room for me to tell that story. I think there's a place for that. But I do think British Columbians generally are quite passionate. And I mean, man, media hasn't left people much choice. This has been all over the news everywhere. So anybody who pays a bit of attention
there's nothing now that the federal government can do, the provincial government as well, that that'll cancel this, right? This is obviously inevitable, right?
No, to the contrary, the Joint Review Panel's statement, conditional approval, was a recommendation, but the final word has yet to come, and that comes from Cabinet. So that's the Conservative government, Stephen Harper and his Cabinet, will have the final say on this, and they're the ones who actually say yes or no. And they are expected, as I understand it, to make a decision in the next 6 months, probably in July sometime. That's my understanding of the situation, without any particularly close connections. But I do know for a fact that it's Cabinet who will decide whether this happens. And, you know, they haven't exactly been cagey about their position. They've been calling this a national priority since before it was even announced by the company itself, pretty much. So that we'll see where everyone kind of expects them to approve it, and then we'll see where it goes from there. That's when, you know, First Nations are the ones who hold a lot of power as far as launching court cases, arguing that, well, they have various arguments they can make. And that'll be probably, you know, that's sort of where the betting money is. And then we'll see what happens after that. But, you know, I think Harper would have to get reelected in first place, mm-hmm. Which is always a possibility. And then I think ultimately he would have to call in the RCMP and the Army in order for this thing to actually be built. So I think that's still some years away, but you know, I'm actually optimistic that Northern Gateway won't happen, not in its current incarnation, anyways.
Now, something that would be good, I guess, is a less of a reliance on and dependence on oil.
that would be nice.
Yeah, do you think we have the will, politically or otherwise, to reduce that, or?
Well, that's the $1 trillion question right now, isn't it? I mean, that's what the whole world is trying to do, and there's many, many good people pushing hard to start veering us towards alternatives and, you know, building whatever infrastructure will come next. I mean, I think it's indisputable that a finite resource will run out one day. And whether or not we can prepare adequately for that day is, I think, the question of what interests me, and that's why I write about these things.
The other thing that I found really interesting, I mean, I've lived in British Columbia my whole life. You've obviously come here from elsewhere. But it must have been a great learning experience to go up and down the coast as you have.
And, yeah, it was tremendous.
And really understand British Columbia a little bit better. I mean, I certainly have, in terms of reading the book, just as to the coastline and what's there. Did you find that personally rewarding?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. And, you know, thanks. I'm glad to hear that you learned some stuff, because I sure did. And that's part of the joy of my job, I think. It's one of the great delights of doing what I do is to go to these places and see these things for myself and learn about them and sort of try to wrap my mind around them. And, you know, the question you answer, 50 more come up, but you try to carve some sort of awareness for yourself out of that. And it's, you know, to realize that we have this gem of coastal BC right in our own backyards, and that it's just there for anyone to go behold and take part in, and it's just so bountiful. And in this age, which is not the most optimistic age for environmental journalists, to have a place like the Great Barrier Rainforest just sitting right there, just around the corner from Vancouver, barely 400 kilometers away. It's just right there. It's so close, and it's just another universe. And it was really nice to behold that and to sink my teeth into it for a few months.
Well, what's next for you, Arno?
Yeah, good question. I mean, I don't know is the short answer. We'll see. Keep doing what I'm doing. I don't have any big projects in mind right now. Hopefully there's still room for, well, unfortunately there is still a need for some voices in this Northern Gateway saga, because as we were just talking about with the conditional approval and the Cabinet decision pending, I think this is right now at a very interesting stage, and it's sort of entered the world of the public domain, which is kind of a sloppy place, but I think I'd like to put a few words in. So I'll stay involved in this issue and others like it, but I don't have too many specifics that I can offer you.
This is a wonderfully written book, and whether you are for or against Northern Gateway, I think you'll appreciate the great writing in here. Congratulations on this book, and thanks for your time today.
Thanks very much. It's been a real pleasure to chat with you.
The website for more, arnokopeski.com. The event with the Writers Fest is this Wednesday, the 29th, at 7:30 at the library downtown. Arno Kopeski joined me on the line from Sook in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plato.